Chapter 6, The Professor, The Problem, and The Palace. Today, Professor Peter Pete Smith was every student's favourite. This morning, he bustled into the lecture hall wearing a tweed suit, bow tie, and shiny red shoes. He wore gold spectacles which framed a pair of kind blue eyes. Pete never had the same hairstyle 2 days in a row. The students weren't sure if he changed it because he genuinely liked experimenting or because he just wanted to give them a laugh. As Pete entered his lecture hall at UCL's Faculty of Arts and Humanities, his students all stopped talking immediately and focused on the professor. "Class, I'm afraid I must begin today by sharing some rather shocking information," Pete announced. "The head of gender studies tortures animals on her days off for sexual pleasure. Do you really want someone like that teaching at this establishment? If you don't, please write to the dean and tell them you don't want a puppy puncher in your community." Pete paused for dramatic effect. "For those who don't believe me, here is an image that might convince you." Pete rolled the blackboard behind him, revealing a rather good caricature of the gender studies professor, looking as if she were about to eat a puppy. Above it, the words, "Animal Abuser," had been written in large, bold letters. Most of the class laughed, albeit a little nervously. Some looked confused. Others looked offended. "What have I just done?" Pete asked the class.
"Lied!"
shouted a girl with blue hair from the front row.
"Correct, Miss Grant. I have lied. Not only have I engaged in horrific slander, but I have also put it into writing, and therefore compounded my statement into libel."
Pete tapped his drawing with his extendable pointer for extra emphasis.
"Of course, there are ways I can make these accusations with no risk to my good legal standing and still jeopardize Miss Field's stellar reputation, and all I have to do is add one small bit of punctuation."
Pete produced, with a flourish, a brightly coloured marker. He added a sizable purple question mark after the word abuser.
"Now, I'm not committing any wrongdoing. I'm just asking questions. Also known as the Murdoch defence. But Murdoch didn't invent it. Politicians have been doing this for centuries. And it is all part of what we will be talking about today."
Pete rolled his blackboard again. The new board that came into view only had one word inscribed upon it. "Propaganda" had been written out in fluorescent orange.
"In particular, propaganda and its close relationship to democracy."
Pete spun back to face the class and began marching dramatically towards them. His hair, which had been swept back, was becoming more and more unkempt with every step. Pete pointed to a happy-looking girl in a fluffy pink sweater.
"Miss Watkins, what is an effective piece of historical propaganda?"
"Nazi propaganda against Jews in Germany," Miss Watkins ventured.
"Perfect, Miss Watkins."
Pete charged back to the board and wrote in vivid green,
"The propaganda against Jews in Nazi Germany. Okay, Miss Watkins, let's expand. Why did the Nazis need to use propaganda?"
"Was it to turn people against the Jews?" said Miss Watkins hesitantly.
"You have answered my question with another question. You'll make a fantastic politician."
Pete smiled warmly, looking at her with those deep blue eyes. "Think?"
Well, because Nazi Germany was still a democracy, they needed a large number of the people on side in order to do anything without facing massive resistance.
Very good, twinkled Pete. The Jews had been persecuted by authorities, both religious and regal, for centuries in Europe, without the need of such widespread formalized disinformation. But with popes and kings, their word was law, and their subjects did not have the strength or tools to challenge them. Pausing for breath and trying to flatten his hair to no avail, Pete continued, "But in a democracy, if you want to commit something that most people will find horrific, you need to convince them that evil is good, black is white, and lies are truth."
Pete's words hung in the air. He then walked up and down the aisles of the lecture hall asking for more examples of propaganda. Communist Russia, American exceptionalism, Hillary's emails, the gender pay gap. Within 10 minutes there was pandemonium. Some people were shouting vicious insults at each other. There was a loud tutting from other corners, and about 3 different male students couldn't stop recommending podcasts. Pete, who had returned to the front of the class quite some time ago, coughed loudly.
Another great advantage of propaganda is its ability to get people to fight amongst themselves. It can create a perfect distraction for those who wish to take advantage.
Pete gestured to the pile of phones, laptops and bags which had appeared on his desk.
Who would like their things back? Pete asked with an impish grin.
The students let out a laugh of surprise as if they'd just witnessed a master magician.
Now, propaganda can be used to fulfill a variety of aims, but in most cases, propaganda has one primary function: the end of any true democracy.
He began returning the possessions to his students.
When you change the meaning of words and subvert reality, even the most simple moral problem leaves the populace with an immoral result. A hypothetical example. You have a leader who has always been in charge of the country he built. He has many advisers, many helpers. But his word is law. He is always right. He cannot be opposed. What would we call him?
Pete surveyed the hall.
Jenkins.
Pete's selection clearly startled Jenkins. His recently returned water bottle fell to the floor.
You're a dictator, sir, said Jenkins from underneath his desk.
A dictator? Yes. Now, this, to most people, is a bad word. It has connotations of other bad words: oppression, fear, dominance. Now, in this theoretical country, imagine there is one advisor, respected more than any other citizen.
Pete's eyes drifted to the ceiling. He seemed to be daydreaming. Pete's upward gaze caused him to miss the latecomer. The man in the golden coat silently opened the door at the back of the lecture hall, taking an empty seat in the last row.
One day, this respected adviser decides that he could lead the country better. He rallies support to challenge the leader's control. When the leader hears of this, he takes his once favoured adviser and all his followers and banishes them from the country they love. He imprisons them in a place worse than death.
Pete looked down, a shadow falling across his face. He looked old for the first time. Unseen to the professor, the man in the golden coat gently shook his head. After a moment of quiet reflection, Pete looked up again, his usual smile returning.
This is a very famous story. You all know it. We are here to study humanity, ethics, philosophy. So I ask you, who is the hero of the story? The leader or his advisor?
A girl in the front row raised her hand. Pete nodded at her. The advisor. He was the one who stood up for democracy.
Pete gave the girl a sad little smile. You would hope so, Miss Hart, wouldn't you? But all it takes is a little propaganda to turn the advisor into a devil. Are you bringing fire to the people, or are you stealing from the gods?
Miss Hart gulped. Miss Watkins, the girl in the fluffy pink sweater, was scribbling down the professor's every word. He really was a brilliant teacher, and he continued this brilliance right up until the bell rang.
Oh, goodness! That's us done for the day. Where does the time go? Our class dismissed.
The students filed out, a low hum of chatter filling the air. Pete returned to his blackboard, pulled down his caricature, and began to methodically wipe the board clean.
After all these years, you still can't let it go.
Pete whirled round to find Adam grinning at him. His eyes widened, his hair lost whatever composure it had, and the old professor ran to embrace him.
My dear boy!
Pete squeezed him hard, then pulled back and grabbed Adam's face.
Let me look at you.
He turned it from side to side, checking it over the way a carpenter might look for imperfections. Satisfied that all was as it should be, he let go.
I feared the worst. When? How? You're here.
Tears brimmed in Pete's eyes. Adam's were also looking a little misty. It was good to see his kind face again.
I'm fine.
Where have you been?
Well, I spent the last 200 chasing a lead through the branches and roots of Yggdrasil. 8 bloody realms, giants and dwarfs and fire.
Adam was now pacing up and down at the front of the lecture hall.
You've been away from Earth for 200 years? Pete asked.
Yeah, I know, right?
So much has changed. Have you seen the cars? Amazing. Anyway, it's always the last realm you look. Wasn't until I got to Aflheim that I actually found something useful. So then I had to...
Adam hesitated. There were some parts of his journey that he knew his old friend would not approve of, and there was no sense in worrying him for no reason.
And then I had to come straight here. But we'll get back to me, Adam continued quickly. What about you,
It's Pete now,
the professor interrupted.
For the moment, I'm keeping my head down. I help my students to open their eyes. I teach them to see the world how it is, not how others would have us look upon it, or something else just as profound. Oh, it is wonderful to see you.
Adam grabbed Pete by the shoulders.
Yeah, well, that's great, Pete. I'm glad you're happy, but I'm about to make you even happier.
You found her?
Pete's voice quivered a little.
Yes, a bit. I think I'm definitely closer. That's why I'm here.
We've got a quest,
Adam said, a tempting half smile on his lips.
Yes? Pete asked.
He knew that look. We're going to hunt down the Queen of England.
The walk to Buckingham Palace was a pleasant one. Adam filled Pete in on what he'd been up to, leaving out a few more details that might get him into trouble, and eventually they found themselves outside the front gates of a large white rectangular building. Adam thought it looked rather conservative for a royal seat. There weren't even any turrets. He assessed the gate's height and stepped back, checking his run-up distance, almost knocking over a tourist as he did so.
I can make it, Adam declared.
No, you can't. And even if you could, you'd never get away with it, Pete said patiently. You see all those little boxes everyone has?
Pete had noticed the little boxes. They were hard to miss. It seemed as if almost everyone had one in their hands at all times. Yeah, actually, I saw a lawman use one. They're maps, right?
Maps?
Pete exclaimed.
No, not just maps. Those little boxes are more powerful than you can possibly imagine. And if you really shouldn't be drawing attention to yourself, you know, I should have mentioned it before, but the coat, dear boy, the coat.
Adam was still not entirely sure what these little boxes could do, but he thought it best to listen to Pete. He always ended up in trouble when he didn't. So, as well as not leaping the fence, and although he liked his coat in its original colour, it probably was a little showy, so he grabbed its lapels. And, with a little tug, the brilliant gold flicked to a dull camel. The tourist, whom Adam had almost knocked down, looked on in astonishment. Anne's Newbert was reminded of a bulb being turned off under a lampshade. Better? Adam asked.
Yes, said Pete.
Fine. So, how does one get to see a queen in these times? Asked Adam as he resumed his evaluation of the palace gates, his eyes flicking up and down like a cat assessing a garden fence.
Slay a dragon? Chortled Pete.
Adam spun to face Pete, his expression boyish with excitement. It had been so long since he'd even seen a dragon. Pete rolled his eyes.
I was being sarcastic.
Not sure I like sarcasm on you. I don't think you can pull it... Adam stopped suddenly. He had a habit of distracting himself.
He'd just spotted a very strange-looking man. A man dressed so ostentatiously that he made the recently vanished gold of Adam's coat look positively dull.
He was wearing a bright red jacket with white trim and large brass buttons. His hat was jet black, 2 feet tall and furry. He also had a sword. A guard.
How about we get ourselves some of those fantastic uniforms? Adam suggested excitedly. We knock him out, finish his watch, and then we go in.
At this point, Pete decided it would be prudent to take matters into his own hands. He made his way towards a kiosk marked Buckingham Palace Tours.
We wait until the rest of the platoon has fallen asleep and then make our way into the Queen's bedchamber, Adam continued breathlessly, not noticing the absence of his partner in crime. His plan was coming together.
The guard Adam had spotted, who hadn't moved a muscle, couldn't help but flick a nervous eye towards the man who seemed to be purposefully making his way towards him and talking quite loudly to himself. Just as Adam was about to reach the guard, Pete's hand landed on his shoulder. Adam turned around to see the kindly professor smiling at him, 2 slips of official-looking paper in his hand. The guard in the tremendous hat let out a sigh of relief.
I've got us some tickets, said Pete calmly. We're getting in.
Adam smiled with a flicker of disappointment and started to follow Pete towards a side gate. But at the last moment, he spun on his heels, pulling up close to the still, still guard.
Lucky escape, my friend. Your sword shall stay sheathed this day.
I like your hat. And with that, Adam followed Pete and a small group of ticketed tourists into the palace. Rachel Nolan had been giving tours at Buckingham Palace for 10 years, but this afternoon's 5 o'clock was the strangest by far. Her group had 2 late additions, an academic-looking gentleman with wild hair, and a younger man who had the energy and temperament of an untrained Labrador.
We are now coming to the red and blue Chinese luncheon room, Rachel said, doing her best to maintain a solemn dignity.
This is amazing, the Labrador yelled, interrupting her flow.
Rachel turned to find him pointing at a very grand painting of Queen Victoria and beaming.
That is Queen Victoria, she tried to explain, but it was no use. Look how good this painting is. This is like Sistine good. Oh, I've missed art.
Rachel turned to his elderly companion for help. The older man smiled at her.
gesturing that she could continue onward with the rest of the group. Pete was happy to see Adam so spellbound. He knew how rarely the boy got to stop and smell the roses.
Would you like me to take your picture? Pete suggested, taking out his own box.
Adam looked at him confused, but struck a pose, nevertheless, as if ready to be immortalized in marble.
How's this? Adam asked.
Peter failed to suppress a small chuckle.
Try a smile.
Adam smiled.
Here we are, my boy.
Pete turned the phone round, revealing a miniature version of Adam posing awkwardly, his schoolboy's smile in stark contrast to the grim-looking canvas queen over his shoulder. Adam took the phone and examined the picture.
"Welcome to the world of today," said Pete.
"Huh, that's me." Adam had never seen his own face so clearly. He'd caught reflections of himself in the ice sheets of Niflheim, on the surface of polished dwarven armour, and, just this afternoon, in the storefront of a merchant's called Argos. And this was clearer than any mirror he'd ever gazed upon. His raven, tightly knitted hair was cut short. The bags under his storm-like eyes were dark. He studied that face which had lived through so many trials and labours. This was the last one. He was sure of it. Someone tapped Adam on the shoulder. He turned to face a very bored-looking man in a drab vest with a badge that read Security.
"I'm afraid you're going to have to delete that, sir. We don't allow pictures in here, and please... stick with the group."
Adam was about to protest, but Pete took the phone off him and guided him away.
"Oh, yes, yes, sorry, good sir."
What did he mean? Delete it.
Delete? That's very aggressive, Adam questioned, slightly panicked. "It's all right, we can take another one later."
How many?
"As many as we want."
What? How can they all fit in there?
"If they go to the cloud."
Adam glanced to the sky out of a nearby window. Amazing.
"Come along, my boy. Enough dawdling. I thought we had a quest."
The old man's eyes flashed under his gold-rimmed spectacles. The two rejoined the group. Rachel clocked their return and, quashing her desire to reprimand them, ploughed on.
"And here we have an icon from 1380 depicting Mary and Babe above and the crucifixion down below.
Excuse me, my dear, where does the Queen stay when she's here?"
"We were just getting to that," Rachel said, her voice clipped. "The royal family's private apartments are just down the hall."
She gestured towards a long corridor. Pete lifted his hand surreptitiously to whisper to Adam.
"All right, what's the plan?"
But Adam was already bounding down the corridor.
"No, sir, you can't do that," Rachel protested. "I'm sorry, he's never been the best at rules," Pete apologised over his shoulder, already chasing after his friend. "Security!"
Adam was opening as many doors as he could. So far, he'd found 3 bedrooms, a parlour and a cleaning cupboard. He was beginning to lose hope, until he turned a corner into another lavish corridor. At the end of it stood a large door, decorated in a gorgeous gold-leaf frieze. In front of it, 2 men, wearing black suits and stern expressions.
"I need to see the Queen,"
he announced. The 2 suited men looked up in alarm, reaching for their revolvers by their side. Adam leapt into the air. Landing on his hands, he sprung himself between the 2. By the time the men had got their guns out, Adam's feet had connected with the door. The wood around the handles splintered. The door burst open, and Adam fell into an extremely fancy parlour. 3 fat-bellied corgis, who up until then had been enjoying a very relaxing afternoon, began yapping wildly. The two suited members of the Royal Protection Squad watched on in horror as the intruder performed a rather graceful somersault before landing flat on his back. He'd arrived at the feet of the Queen of England, who was perched upright on a blue velvet couch. The Queen was remarkably calm, given the circumstances, and continued to sip tea. The two red-faced guards drew up their barrels and aimed at her new visitor. The Queen raised her hand.
"That will be all, gentlemen, and let that man behind you in on your way out."
The Queen gestured to Pete, who had now caught up, his puffed face peering from between the two guards.
"Mom?"
Working at the palace, serviceman Trevor Fortescue thought he'd seen everything but this.
"Oh, forgive me, did I not enunciate?"
said the monarch demurely, the smallest hint of a smile on her face.
"Sorry, ma'am, but I wouldn't be doing my duty if I didn't say that this..."
Trevor tried, but the Queen gave him a look that made it clear that the matter was over.
"If you insist, ma'am."
"I do."
Trevor moved, allowing the old man behind him to pass.
"Thank you," said Pete,
as the two guards begrudgingly left the room, carefully closing the now damaged door behind them. The paperwork on this one would be a nightmare. The Queen looked at Adam, who was still sprawled out on the floor.
"I think you can get up now," she said, her smile widening.
"Our apologies, Your Majesty," said Pete, bowing his head slightly. "Yeah, I wouldn't have barged in like that if it wasn't very..."
"Don't be ridiculous,"
the Queen interrupted, taking another long sip of her tea.
"I've been waiting to meet you since the coronation."
You've been listening to Evergreen, Chapter 6, written by Sam Russell and read by Catherine Russell. If you enjoyed it, wherever you're listening, please subscribe, give us a like and a review so we can get this story into more people's ears. And if you really liked it, you can support this project on our Ko-fi page. All the details are available on our Twitter, @evergreenbook1. The next chapter will be available on Monday, the 23rd of August. Thanks for listening.
Hi, Sam Russell here. If you enjoyed that chapter, we've got our next one coming up in 2 weeks' time. But if you can't wait till then and you want some more audio fantasy, we've got a recommendation for you. The world is ending, or did it end again? You think someone would have bothered to tell them. The tales of Sada Emadu follow the lives of characters living in the threat-blind capital of a dying world as they try to live their lives and keep their city from falling into chaos. All of this whilst dealing with revolutionary politics, interstate competition, technological disruption, and the daily challenges of the weird and wonderful world of Ursid Lakri, the land of no return. You can find links to the tales of Sada Emadu in the show notes, but you can also find them on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Give it a listen. We love it.